coming up on Economics Explored.
And so we're struggling to find a way to try to use our tax code to help level the playing field, especially as it was tilted so much to the best off in our society as a result of the pandemic. And we're still struggling. It's not clear that we're going to be able to tackle any of the challenges President Biden hoped to tackle.
Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist based in Brisbane, Australia, and I'm a former Australian Treasury official. This is episode 114 on tax policies favouring tech billionaires and hedge fund managers. My guest this episode is US tax policy expert Steve Rosenthal. Steve and I explore some of the US tax policy settings which are often mentioned in the debate around taxing the wealthy. For instance, we often hear about the special tax treatment of carried interest, which is relevant to the taxation of hedge fund managers, and we also hear about the step up in basis, which is relevant to the taxation of capital gains. With Steve, I also explore the tax arrangements of former President Donald Trump, regarding which Steve has testified before a congressional committee. This is a deeper exploration of US tax policy settings than I've done previously, in episode 112 to be precise, in which I chatted with Professor Miranda Stewart from the University of Melbourne about the proposed US billionaire tax, among other things. I received a favourable reaction to that episode and I felt it would be worthwhile to delve a little deeper. If you're outside of the US, I hope this episode will still be of interest to you because I think it's important for all of us to understand what's going on in what is still arguably the world's most powerful nation and is still the largest or the second largest economy, depending on the metric used. My guest this episode, Steve Rosenthal, is a senior fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. Before joining the Urban Institute, Steve practiced tax law in D.C. for over 25 years, most recently as a partner at Ropes & Gray. Steve was a legislation counsel with the Joint Committee on Taxation, where he helped draft tax rules for financial institutions, financial products, capital gains, and related areas. Steve is the former chair of the taxation section of the District of Columbia Bar Association, and in 2013, he was the staff director of the DC Tax Revision Commission. So he's obviously well qualified to speak about US tax policy. Please check out the show notes for links to materials mentioned in this episode and for any clarifications. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions relating to this episode or to previous episodes, then please either email them to me via contact@economicsexplored.com or record them in a message via SpeakPipe, and I can share them with other listeners in a future episode. You can find a link to the SpeakPipe service in the show notes. Righto. Now for my conversation with Steve Rosenthal of the Urban Institute. Thanks to my audio engineer, Josh Krotz, for his assistance in producing this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Steve Rosenthal, Senior Fellow in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, excellent, Steve. I'm keen to chat with you about issues around taxing the wealthy. This has become a big issue in both of our countries recently. There's been a lot more debate about inequality and whether tax policy settings on the wealthy are appropriate. And in the US, you've been having this discussion around the billionaire tax. And as an outsider, it's difficult for me to get a sense of what the tax policy settings are over in the States. There seems to be a lot of complexity there. There's talk about carried interest. There's talk about this step up in basis. And I'd be grateful if you could help us or help me understand, and people in the audience, what the major issues are with taxing the wealthy in the States. Would carried interest be a good place to begin?
Oh, probably not. Okay. That's one of the more complicated areas. I'm familiar with all the issues and happy to chat about them. To start big, in the U.S., we have an income tax system. We also have a tax on estates, you know, at death, although our estate tax is rather porous. And so there's a lot of ways to get around that. And it doesn't kick in until you're very, very wealthy, a couple having more than $24 million US in assets. But our income tax system is the heart of our tax. Our income tax rules are the heart of our system. And one of the challenges is in the US, there needs to be income in order for there to be tax. And income arises when somebody actually sells an asset and realizes gain. If a U.S. taxpayer does not sell an asset, there is no realized gain. And if the asset is carried into the estate until death, then the low basis is stepped up to fair market value. And so we have like Mark Zuckerberg, who might have a very small piece, a small investment in his Facebook stock, maybe half a billion or so over the years. And the stock itself is worth $100 billion. And so until he sells that stock, he does not pay tax. If he were to sell the stock, he would pay a capital gains tax. And the capital gains tax rate here is lower, about by half of the regular income tax. But he can hold his stock until death, and then it's stepped up. That half a billion dollar cost basis is stepped up to the fair market value of $100 billion, and that appreciation escapes U.S. income tax completely. Now, as I mentioned earlier, capital gains rates are favorable, 20% compared to the top rate of 37% on regular income. And so some investors who actually want to sell assets arrange their affairs so that their sales generate long-term capital gains. And carried interest is a way for private equity managers to compensate themselves with a share of the profits of a private equity fund, and those profits come out as long-term capital gains. And so they're taxed very lightly, long-term capital gains rates of 20%. But again, stepping back, I think the most pressing question for us is, how should we tax the rich? And the rich, you know, are different than you and me. They own a lot of assets. And we tax those assets lightly in the States. We tax them not at all if they're not sold, when they're sold at lower tax rates. And then if they're carried into death, then maybe there's an estate tax, but we don't collect much there either. And so, as we in the States have observed a real run-up in the value of the stock market and in assets, especially post-pandemic, the rich are doing very, very well compared to the working class, and they don't face much taxes either. So did you follow some of that there?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I hear this step up in basis is an important part of it. They talk about, is it buy, borrow, and die? That's the strategy where the ultra wealthy will borrow against their stocks, and they will use the money that they borrow to spend, and so that's not counted as income. And this is what people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are doing. Is that essentially what they're doing?
That's a fair summary. Yes, especially for our entrepreneurs, you know, the Elon Musks, the Bezos, the Mark Zuckerberg, they've done fabulously well with the companies that they have founded. And so they're sitting on mega amounts of appreciated assets. Were they to sell them, they would trip a very large capital gains tax at a reduced tax rate. However, it still would be taxed. But what they do instead of selling their appreciated assets is borrow against them, secure the loan, say, with their appreciated stock, and avoid selling the stock and tripping the tax. A borrowing in the States is not a taxable event. Only the sale of an asset is a taxable event. And so that's how they can manage their tax liability. And ProPublica, a periodical in the U.S., stumbled across some confidential IRS records with respect to the ultra wealthy. And it turns out that the ultra, ultra wealthy in this country those having $1 billion or $10 billion or $100 billion of assets, they don't have to sell many of their assets to live very well. First off, when you have that much money, I suspect it's actually hard to sell, you know, hard to spend as much as you might think is, you know, to support the lifestyle. It's just a lot of money. And then secondly, they can borrow, as you say. They invest at the start, or they buy at the start their companies. But then from that point forward, they borrow against their appreciated positions, appreciated stock. And then when they die, the basis is stepped up to fair market value. And that appreciation, that unrealized gain, escapes tax completely.
Okay. What would be the what are the areas of debate in terms of what could be changed? So with capital gains tax, I mean, is it the case that there is actually a rationale for having a lower rate of tax on capital gains because of inflation? Because part of any capital gain will be inflation, and so therefore there's a rationale for a lower tax rate. And what about there's this argument that, oh, well, it'd be unfair to tax on people on these unrealized capital gains. These are paper gains. And so that's one of the arguments. What do you think is the, do you have any views on what would be the best way to deal with this situation? I mean, is it this case that arguably the ultra wealthy are paying less tax than they should?
I think capital gains rates might yet be increased. They're not low in our country because of inflation. Historically, we had lower capital gains tax rates than ordinary income tax rates to reduce the lock-in effect, to induce more holders of assets to sell the assets rather than carry them into death and have the basis stepped up.
Okay.
My own view, and one way to deal with that issue of lock-in and the fact that people could yet hold their assets until death is to adopt what Chairman Wyden of our Senate Finance Committee proposed, a billionaire's tax. And a billionaire's tax, at least under Chairman Wyden's approach, would tax any unrealized gains every single year. Paper gains. And so if the stock goes up, that appreciation would be subject to tax. The problem with taxing paper gains and artificial transactions is that there is no real transaction. So sometimes we don't know the value of a position if it hasn't been sold. Some stock is traded publicly and we can look up the price in the newspaper. But even for those positions, a large block of stock might not be so easy to value. And of course, some stock and assets are private and not publicly traded, and so it'd be hard to figure out what the value is. And the other problem that policymakers think about when they talk about deeming sales to occur every year and squeezing out the unrealized gain whether or not a sale arises is if there's no sale, there are no cash proceeds, and the taxpayer may not have the money to pay the tax. You might say for billionaires, we're a little unsympathetic because they have a lot of assets and a lot of money, but their assets might be tied up in one stock, and they may not be able to borrow so easily, and they may not be able to sell that stock without really depressing the market. My favorite approach to this problem is to combine leave in place the lower capital gains tax rates, hoping to induce some sales during lifetime, but then tax unrealized gains at death and tax them at ordinary higher tax rates to induce more sales during a lifetime, because the rich person will not be able to benefit from holding the asset until death. And in my view, that might yet free up assets to move around in our economy somewhat better. Now, that approach, you know, as President Biden suggested during the campaign and proposed to the Congress, although he was going to tax unrealized gains at death at capital gains rates and not ordinary rates. I sort of would like a little higher rate if somebody holds a position until death. There is, by the way, as you suggest, an inflation element to the gain, but that's often offset by the deferral aspect of paying the tax. If you can pay the tax later rather than earlier, you can save money on a present value basis.
Yeah.
And so those two effects often offset each other.
That's
but returning to President Biden's approach of taxing unrealized gains at death, I thought that was quite clever. It would induce more sales during life. And again, if you raise the rates a little so they are higher at death than at during life, you might even get more sales during life. We could collect more revenue. But we have a problem in this country with farmers, that there is the mythic family farm. And whenever there's a tax collected at death, whether it's a gain at death or an estate tax at death or an inheritance tax at death, we have a disproportionate number of members of Congress who come from rural areas. And they argue that the family farm would be forced to be sold. And that's of sentimental value and is at the heart of our country's fortunes, say. I don't really know what. They spin out a lot of motherhood and apple pie sort of stories here. Now, Biden proposed, if he were going to collect a larger tax at death, he was going to allow family farms and small businesses and family-owned businesses to delay paying the tax, to pay in installments over many years, and not even collect the tax while the family continued to own the farm or manage the business. And so there are ways to accommodate the sensitivity to the family farm and the family-owned business facing a large tax at death that might yet force the family to dispose of the business or the farm. There are approaches to alleviate those concerns, but the politics being what they are, the subtleties of the taxation scheme are lost. It's just whenever there's an estate tax, the politicians talk about losing the family farm and the business. And we have Murdoch here, which controls a large portion of our media. And he spews a lot of that out into the public discourse. And so it's really hard to have an intelligent conversation about, well, how could we tax the Bezoses and the Musks and the Zuckerbergs without taxing the family farms and the small businesses? I think there are ways, but it faces a lot of political opposition.
Yeah, that's something I didn't appreciate. I can see why that would be politically challenging. And I mean, we'd have similar issues here. I mean, I don't know what the situation is in the States. I know Bill Gates owns a lot of farmland, but we still do have family farms here in Australia, say out on the Darling Downs, west of Brisbane, where I am. So we still do have that element. So that would be an important consideration here. Okay. I just note too, Elon Musk is actually selling some shares now, isn't he? So he had that vote on Twitter the other week, and now he's in a spat with Bernie Sanders over something or other I saw over Twitter. I don't know if you saw that today.
He has an ongoing fight with Bernie Sanders. Now, Elon Musk has a whole bunch of Tesla stock, much of it acquired many years ago with a low-cost basis. But the stock that he sold this week was stock that he received in exercise of some executive options. Over the years, Elon Musk has acquired lots of Tesla stock, much of it through exercising executive options that were compensation for his management role. And under our tax rules, when an option is exercised, there must be income at that time. And after the income is recognized, the cost basis of the stock is set to its then fair market value, the exercise price of the option. And so Elon Musk really had very little choice if he wanted to maintain these profitable options, and they were going to expire by December, as I understand, he had to exercise them. Yeah. And he had to recognize a lot of tax. And if he sold these options, he could, if he sold the stock that he acquired from his options, he would have the money to pay the tax, and the money that he collected would have been raised from the sale of high cost basis assets. So there'd be relatively little gain for him to pay on the recently acquired stock. He still has billions of dollars of Tesla stock that he acquired years and decades ago. And for that, I think he's going to hold on to death, as you suggested earlier. Many of our billionaires do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it could be a clever play from Elon Musk. I just want to go back to that carried interest. That's fascinating. So is it the case that these hedge fund managers, so their income is recognized as this carried interest as a capital gain, and they're paying this lower rate of tax on it. So arguably, they're not paying their fair share, so to speak. Would that be a fair assessment?
That's the issue. Tax policy people label that horizontal equity, that private equity fund managers, they pay taxes at 20% rate, where wage earners pay at 37%. Even an investment banker, say, that is compensated very well with bonuses and wages and things of that sort for doing similar kinds of activity, they pay tax at the top rate of 37%, not the 20% reduced capital gains rate. And that, again, is a result of the way that private equity funds are organized. What happens is the managers of the funds, the private equity managers, rather than take a salary or receive bonuses, they arrange for a share of the profits of the fund. And when the fund sells assets and generates long-term capital gains, the private equity manager's compensation is the share of those long-term capital gains. And so it's actually a challenging issue as to how to make sure those private equity fund managers pay taxes at the top rate, not the lower capital gains rate, because they are receiving as compensation a share of the profits, which typically would be long-term capital gains. And Congress has been trying since 2007 with the first hearing for almost 15 years now to tax carried interest in the compensation of private equity managers at regular rates. They are very fierce opposition. The private equity managers hold a lot of companies in this country. Their business is to acquire portfolio companies, businesses, and then try to restructure them to make a profit and then sell the stock up after they've restructured them. And they hold so many companies across our country that every member of Congress will have either a private equity fund manager or fund in his or her jurisdiction, or a portfolio company owned by a private equity fund. And so they have a lot of sway in our Congress with respect to their wishes. And in any event, many people believe it's unfair, myself included, that private equity managers can derive compensation subject to a tax rate, half the tax rate that, other wage earners might yet face.
Right. And is it the result of longstanding rules in the U.S. tax code that...
Largely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's a series of rules that have unfolded. The private equity funds are organized as partnerships. And partnerships in our country are known as pass-through or flow-through entities. They pass through their gains to their partners or flow through their gains to their partners. And so it's longstanding that when a partner in a partnership receives a capital gain distribution from the partnership, it's taxed as capital gains. And separately, when the private equity manager first acquires the profits interest, the partner's interest in the partnership, that's early on when the partnership interest has very little value. And so there's no tax at the start. And then when the money starts rolling in later, the taxes at lower rates. And all of these are elements of our tax code. The private equity fund managers are very well advised. In fact, in my prior life, when I was practicing law, some of my clients were private equity managers. They can afford to pay the top rate for lawyers. And so we law professionals also like to work with private equity funds. So they're very powerful in this country, and they've organized their affairs so that the individuals that manage the private equity funds pay low tax rates. But low tax rates, 20%, is still higher than zero, which is what Zuckerberg and Bezos and Musk at some with respect to some of his stock, what they will pay. And so, again, in our country, there's a very wide gap between those who have assets and those who don't. And when you have assets, there's just a lot of tax planning that can be done to reduce your tax liability.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, and speaking of people tax planning to reduce their tax liabilities, the final thing I want to ask you about, Steve, I noticed you testified before a congressional committee last year. Was it the, let me find it. You testified in October 2020 before the Hearing on Tax Fairness, Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Oversight, United States House of Representatives, and it was a case study of President Donald Trump. I'm wondering if you could just go through how the former president's tax affairs illustrate how the wealthy can minimize their tax. I thought that was a fascinating bit of testimony.
Well, Donald Trump arranges his affairs in quite complicated fashion. He's got over 500 so-called pass-through entities, partnerships and LLCs and some S corporations. And there are layers upon layers of these pass-through entities. And so it's quite a challenge to figure out what exactly he's up to. But some of our press has managed to acquire some pieces of Donald Trump's tax return information, starting, I guess, in 1995 through 2021. And Donald Trump rarely pays any taxes.
Yeah.
I first started studying Donald Trump's taxes when the New York Times shared some tax return information that they had obtained with me and a bunch of documents. And I went to New York and sorted through those documents. And Donald Trump had created $916 million of net operating losses. And those are losses in excess of profits. And those losses in excess of profits result in zero tax for the current year. And under our system, zero taxes until the losses offset future profits. And Donald Trump managed to generate those losses and chiefly through two different aspects. One is he lost a lot of money. He had, for instance, casinos operating and they went bankrupt. He's a very unsuccessful businessman. But what he was successful at was tax planning, so that he generated a whole bunch of real and artificial losses. And he was able to stockpile those and avoid paying taxes. And when he ran through all of the $916 million of losses that had been generated mainly from his casinos, he generated another $700 million of operating losses from the restructuring of a partnership that he owned. I think it was a property in New York. And so once again, he generated lots of losses, which he could use to soak up his income and avoid paying taxes. And I've followed his tax affairs for many years, starting with helping the New York Times when they were looking for an expert. And because I developed this expertise in Donald Trump's taxes, I've been asked to testify to the U.S. Congress a couple of times. So with his departure from office, my side gig as a Donald Trump tax return expert has been of less of value, less demand. But it kept me occupied for a number of years. And who knows, maybe he'll return and we'll have more fun.
Yeah, there's quite a significant probability of that, it appears, given the political news I see coming out of the U.S. with poll numbers for the Democratic Party. So, all very possible. Steve, I'll put a link to that testimony in the show notes. I think it's great stuff. Anything before we wrap up? I found this incredibly interesting. I find it's interesting comparing other countries to Australia. Like, I've got the Australian system in mind, and when I see what happens in other countries, I see things that, oh, hang on, that seems a bit odd, and what's going on there? But I don't know enough of the details, so this has helped me a lot. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
I think we've covered most of the questions that confront our country on taxes. It's just quite striking how the gulf between the rich and the poor have just widened and widened and widened. And I actually am fortunate because I'm a professional, and during the pandemic, I could work from home, and I had saved a lot of money back in the day from when I was in practice, and my investments, my savings really went up during the pandemic. By contrast, a lot of the working class in this country struggled to keep their jobs, you know, as restaurants and sporting facilities closed. They didn't have the savings that they could invest and ride with the stock market upwards. And so the gap between the rich and the poor have widened, and the taxes, which we might expect in our country to help equalize the situation, because we have a progressive tax system charging higher rates for those who make more money, that really has failed us too, because it's not that the rich actually make more taxable income, they don't sell assets. And so we're struggling to find a way to try to use our tax code to help level the playing field, especially as it was tilted so much to the best off in our society as a result of the pandemic. And we're still struggling. It's not clear that we're going to be able to tackle any of the challenges President Biden hoped to tackle. So,
yeah. Okay. Steve Rosenthal from the Urban Institute, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciated it.
Okay. Good luck to y'all.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the end of this episode of Economics Explored. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your family and friends and leave a comment or give us a rating on your podcast app. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, you can feel free to send them to contact@economicsexplored.com, and we'll aim to address them in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Until next week. Goodbye.